Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios.
It's Tuesday, August 18th.
Hi, I'm Kristen Urquiza. I'm one of the many who has lost a loved one to COVID. My dad, Mark Anthony Urquiza, should be here today, but he isn't. He had faith in Donald Trump. He voted for him, listened to him, believed him and his mouthpieces when they said that coronavirus was under control and going to disappear, that it was okay to end social distancing rules before it was safe, and that if you had no underlying health conditions, you'd probably be fine. So in late May, after the stay-at-home order was lifted in Arizona, my dad went to a karaoke bar with his friends. A few weeks later, he was put on a ventilator. And after 5 agonizing days, he died alone in the ICU with a nurse holding his hand. My dad was a healthy 65-year-old. His only pre-existing condition was trusting Donald Trump, and for that, he paid with his life.
Wow. Kristen Urquiza at the Democratic convention last night. We'll have some of Trump's pre-buttal as well from a speech he gave yesterday before this aired. And as we welcome NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid, she covered the Trump campaign in 2016 and is covering Joe Biden this week. Hi, Asma. I know you're crazy busy on convention week, even without a convention. So we really appreciate you giving us some stretch out time. Welcome.
Hi, happy to do it.
And I understand you're covering Biden in Delaware. Can you tell us what that's like in the year of the virtual convention?
Yeah, I mean, it's all very strange, right? Because we don't have the typical fanfare of what a convention's like. But I'm here in Delaware because both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden will be giving speeches. And I will say, Brian, it's the most that I've really felt like I'm actually at a convention. You know, there are some protocols around just making sure we get credentialed and COVID tested, et cetera. I know, you know, folks who go to hear the president often have to do that. And there's similar things here at the DNC this year. Mm-hmm. But I will say it is the most that I've actually felt because I just, you know, this morning actually saw a whole bunch of other journalists and I saw Democratic staffers. I haven't seen that so far. I haven't seen that, frankly, in quite a while because we haven't had large scale events covering Joe Biden. He's mainly just done smaller scale events with pool reporters, which means, you know, a dozen or so mix of journalists. That's about it.
And did the candidate make an appearance yesterday? For those of you who are there, do they have a spin room? Was there anything?
No, nothing of that sort. You know, he's been doing a number of, quote, virtual fundraisers. This is something that the Biden campaign has raised a bucket load of money over. I mean, they've been fairly successful in raising money ever since he became the presumptive nominee. So he had one of those virtual fundraisers yesterday. He'll be having another virtual fundraiser, I believe, today, and a virtual sort of meet and greet with delegates from a couple of key battleground states. But those even are pool events, meaning that one print reporter usually attends the virtual, like, Zoom session online and will send reporter notes to the rest of us. So other than really the events as of now of Wednesday and Thursday, there won't be a whole bunch of reporters in a room, to my knowledge.
I want to take a phone call from Heather on Staten Island, who thinks she knows one of those kind of Kristen Urquiza's father type stories. Let's see what she's got. Heather on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on. So my next door neighbor's uncle, I want to say he's about 70. He actually worked in a funeral home. And when the whole COVID thing first started, the funeral home said, you know, you better lay low for a little while. You know, we're not really sure how this is going to play out. So, but he bought into the whole Trump, it's just the flu, nothing to worry about, nothing to see here. Well, fast forward, he caught COVID, ended up in the hospital, coming very close to death, actually had clotting issues due to COVID, and he had to have his leg amputated.
Oh, my.
Just above the knee. Now he has a prosthetic. Thank goodness he's doing really well now. He got out of the hospital. He was in rehab for a little while. But it was really scary. I mean, for a while, he really had no idea what was going on. You know, mentally, he wasn't there for a while. It really affected him. And so that was just one personal story that I had, knowing somebody that, you know, almost lost someone to COVID. And, you know, that person really just said, oh, it's nothing. It's just the flu. Don't worry about
it. And so as far as you know, Heather, did he, since he lived to tell the tale, unlike poor Kristen Urquiza's father, did he have a political change of heart? Was he a Trump supporter and came out feeling betrayed by Trump from his COVID experience or people around him, if you know?
I'm not really sure. It's a very interesting question. I mean, you know, and right now, I know, for instance, personally, my father-in-law is a very huge Trump fan. He's down in the Villages in Florida. And, you know, he's really not buying into any of the COVID stuff either. And, you know, obviously my husband is very concerned because he hears him, I'm going out to dinner, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And he's going to be 80 in December and has some pre-existing conditions. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's an adult. He can do what he wants. But obviously my husband and I are very concerned about that.
Yeah. Heather, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate your story and your contribution. So Asma Khalid from NPR, we played that Kristen Urquiza clip. A lot of people are citing that today for its power. Any way for you as a political correspondent to tell if it resonates with enough people that there are clusters of stories like that?
I mean, it's so hard to know, Brian. I mean, I think what to me did feel, though, particularly powerful about that moment that Kristen gave is I think a lot of us journalists were saying, and we were sort of skeptical, right, of the nature of how a virtual convention would really come across because it's so fundamentally different than a big, large-scale arena with cheering crowds. To me, the Kristen moment struck at what you can really do that's powerful with a virtual convention. You know, almost instantaneously, I saw that moment being shared on social media, and it's a moment that can easily go viral and be shareable because, you know, as we just heard from one of your listeners, there are people who resonate with her story, who have similar experiences. And we do know that the president's response to the pandemic, when we look at polling, he's not doing too well. And anecdotally, you know, I did some reporting myself recently in Florida, and I heard from Republicans who have not been thrilled with how he's responded to the public health crisis at this point in time.
Asma, before we move on from the Kristen Urquiza story to some other things from last night, I mean, each convention will have its personal horror stories, right? I watched some of the post-convention coverage on Fox last night, and they were emphasizing that the Democrats didn't even talk about street crime or political violence where it has occurred. And they showed a clip of a guy being beaten by a crowd on a street in Portland, a video that's gone viral online. So do you think we'll see that each convention highlights horror stories that fit their narratives?
I think we will. But Brian, I think what's worth remembering is when you look at where general public opinion sentiment is at this point, the president has been trying to highlight the apparent threat, right, of looting, he says, and crime, and he messages to the alleged suburban housewives of America. And that messaging that Joe Biden is soft on crime, that we're living in a particularly dangerous country right now, has not seemed to resonate with people. I will say that that's what we see in public opinion polling, but it's also what I've heard. I've done, you know, reporting in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Florida. I've not heard that from people. I would say, on the contrary, you know, the probably most salient thing I have heard from people is concerns about the pandemic, whether or not their kids can go back to school, and the economic fallout from the pandemic. And so I do think that there is a disconnect while both the Republicans and Democrats will try to highlight, you know, problems that they see in the country. It seems at this point, at least, that the problems that the Democrats highlighted at least yesterday do seem to align better with where most public opinion sentiment is at this point.
Interesting. And we will talk later in the show to a city councilman from Brooklyn, and we will ask him if crime is an issue. Not that we would expect Brooklyn to have a close vote between Biden and Trump, but whether that's an issue resonating in his community as the president is trying to emphasize it. All right, let's go to another clip. And staying on the virus, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who also had a slot in that first hour.
A virus attacks when the body is weak and when it cannot defend itself. Over these past few years, America's body politic has been weakened. The divisions have been growing deeper. The anti-Semitism, the anti-Latino, the anti-immigrant fervor, the racism in Charlottesville, where the KKK didn't even bother to wear their hoods. And in Minnesota, where the life was squeezed from Mr. Floyd. Only a strong body can fight off the virus. And America's divisions weakened it. Donald Trump didn't create the initial division. The division created Trump. He only made it worse. Our collective strength is exercised through government. It is, in effect, our immune system. And our current federal government is dysfunctional and incompetent. It couldn't fight off the virus. In fact, it didn't even see it coming. The European virus infected the Northeast while the White House was still fixated on China.
Governor Cuomo from the virtual DNC. So there was a kind of sarcastic dig. Trump was fixated on China while the Europe virus hit New York. Personally, just as an aside, I thought New York itself was days too slow at starting to check people coming from Europe at the airports once we knew what was going on in Italy. But that doesn't let Trump off the hook. Who is Andrew Cuomo supposed to appeal to in DNC marketing world, Asma?
You know, I think that the message, you know, that Democrats wanted to send in having both him as well as the Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer, speak was to highlight the pandemic. And this goes back to one of the central goals the Democrats were trying to address yesterday, which is a contrast in leadership. And this is what we'd heard from the Biden campaign. We'd heard from Democrats in the lead up to the first night of the convention. They have been trying to show that a Biden presidency would look and feel and offer a lot more fundamentally that's different than what we've seen so far from the president, from President Trump's administration. And fundamentally, that comes down to how the president handled the pandemic. And we know, I'm sure I don't need to tell any of your listeners, but the situation in New York was particularly, you know, difficult to deal with at the beginning of this pandemic. And so I think that the Democrats wanted to choose two states in particular that were hard hit. Michigan, obviously dealing with the crisis in a different way. But, you know, Gretchen Whitmer had difficulty getting enough supplies that she needed. And some of that, you know, Michiganders will tell me, was linked to how they feel that President Trump specifically tried to keep PPE supplies away from their state.
Here are some tweets that are coming in on the convention format. Cynthia on Twitter writes, I love the unconventional convention. Never liked the loud, noisy, screaming style I saw on TV. A real turnoff last night was thoughtful and compelling. I say ditch the old thing and go with the new. But Funny Bone Stuff writes on Twitter, watch the DNC, felt like a giant ad that felt like a rehab clinic orientation video in the lobby before I get my bunk assignment. Ouch. Asma, is there any way for you to get a sense of how this virtual convention format is registering out there? Are there overnight TV ratings or anything that you've seen?
You know, I don't have a great sense. And part of it that's challenging is that a lot of the major broadcast channels were only carrying 1 hour of this convention live. And so you had some folks tuning in online. I will say anecdotally, I don't anticipate that there was tremendous numbers in terms of people watching the Democrats live stream. But you did have some of this shareable on social media. I don't know, though, Brian, that we'll have a clear sense of how much this this very unconventional convention resonated with people or didn't until the week is over, and maybe even until after the Republicans have their own convention. Because, you know, it's not as if people were sitting down and watching multiple hours of this convention on NBC or ABC. That just it wasn't the way that this particular convention came across. But to your listener who wrote in about, you know, the way that it felt, I will say many of us in the newsroom were saying it felt like one giant State of the Union, because you had so many pre-recorded speeches where, you know, there's no applause. There's somebody, say, sitting in their living room or in a couple cases in their, you know, kitchen table. and delivering a speech that's all pre-recorded. And so it did, to me, have
one
feel
giant state
of
the union
long infomercial.
Yeah, one giant
response,
state of the one, response. That's what I was going to say. One giant state of the union response.
Not state of the union. State of the union always has that raucous applause. But this was the response, right? That's all pre-recorded, and it doesn't have that same level of energy. And It was a big infomercial, and I don't know with an infomercial that you have a real clear sense of whether or not people bought what was being sold until a couple of weeks later. I guess we really may not know till quite a while till we see some polling out of both of these conventions.
Another clip. It's a short one from Bernie Sanders. We'll hear a longer one a little later, but this is a brief reference that President Trump anticipated in his speech in Wisconsin yesterday. So we'll hear that too afterwards. Here's Senator Sanders.
Our campaign ended several months ago, but our movement continues and is getting stronger every day. Many of the ideas we fought for that just a few years ago were considered radical are now mainstream. But let us be clear. If Donald Trump is reelected, all the progress we have made will be in jeopardy.
So Bernie on tape last night, here's Trump live in the afternoon.
The voters of Wisconsin face a simple choice. Do you want to be ruled by the radical left mob, or do you want to stand tall as free men and women in the greatest country on earth and keep it that way? Do you want to crush our economy under the crazy socialist policies of sleepy Joe Biden and his boss, Kamala Harris, and his other boss, Nancy Pelosi, she's a beauty, and his ruler, Bernie Sanders, crazy Bernie.
So, Osman, this is the central battleground on two fronts, I think. Bernie Sanders trying to convince his supporters that his agenda has been accepted enough by Joe Biden, and Trump arguing that, Bernie's agenda, radical left, mm-hmm. and Trump's telling, has been accepted by Biden, and that's a threat to swing voters?
Exactly. And so I guess to the first point, I will, say that I thought Bernie Sanders made a fairly strong and effective case to his supporters. And it felt remarkably different to me than what I heard from progressive leaders and activists in 2016. There was a sense, I think, ahead of the 2016 election that, people just assumed Hillary Clinton, I should say on the left, people assumed that Hillary Clinton would win. Now that President Trump has been president for 3+ years, there is a sense, as Bernie Sanders himself explained last night, that some folks on the left see the president as an existential threat to democracy, and they see him as an authoritarian leader. And I thought what Sanders did that was quite effective yesterday was to address his supporters directly and say that, he intends to work with progressives, with moderates, and even conservatives to ensure that Donald Trump is only a one-term president.
Did you hear in the Trump clip, by the way Trump pronounced Kamala Harris's first name, Kamala? This is one of the things I'm just going to label a racist appeal. He's trying to make the name sound somehow exotic and foreign to suggest that this person is not one of us. If it was an accidental one-off mispronounce, it would be one thing, but he says it that way over and over again. I saw one of his sons do it the same on Fox last night. So the idea is, she is not a real American deep down.
I would say, though, Brent, I think he's made that case quite transparent with the request, sort of questioning whether or not she was eligible to be the VP. I think the mispronunciation, I will say, on Trump's behalf, I think he mispronounces a whole bunch of words, and that's fairly routine for him. And to me, whether or not he says Kamala or Kamala, I mean, both are names that are not necessarily widespread, I would say, amongst the American population. So I will say on that front, I've got to give it to him that, I think he often mispronounces words. I think that what's more transparent to me has been what we've heard from some Republicans questioning whether or not she's actually eligible for the job.
Yeah. Of course, he did it the other week with the hurricane. He said, Isaias, very interesting name, because it was a Spanish version of Isaiah. I don't know. If you were running for president, he'd say, asthma, it sounds like a lung disease. Now let's get to Michelle Obama. In this first clip, she refers to the police killing of George Floyd and the president's response.
And here at home, as George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and a never-ending list of innocent people of color continue to be murdered, stating the simple fact that a Black life matters is still met with derision from the nation's highest office.
Derision from the nation's highest office, she charges. And here's Trump yesterday afternoon.
But Biden and Harris are pro-crime and anti-cop. There's no other way to say it. And we're anti-crime. We are pro-cop all the way. I've gotten the endorsement. I got the endorsement, Pat Lynch, New York City Police.
So, and Asma, I know you have to go in a minute. Is that a contrast we'll hear all election season? Trump suggesting not that the killing of George Floyd was justified. He does not make that claim. But that the movement for Black lives is anti-police rather than anti-police brutality.
He has tried to make that argument to date, right? And that is what we've heard when he accuses Joe Biden of being soft on crime or defunding the police, which I should point out, Joe Biden does not want to defund the police. But that is something he has tried. What I think is notable, though, Brian, is that he's had to readjust that messaging. So it was interesting to hear him revert to it. It doesn't seem like it has worked for him to date. Again, you know, it's been a tough campaign cycle to go out and do a lot of anecdotal, you know, on the ground reporting, but you look at public opinion poll after public opinion poll, it's just not a message that seems to be resonating. We've seen that the movement for Black lives has greater support, you know, in the past couple of months than it's traditionally had. I myself have been out to protests in suburbs, say it's Kenosha, Wisconsin, or Grand Rapids, Michigan. And these protest movements have been remarkably diverse, full of young white people, Latinos, Asian Americans, African Americans. And so there is a sense that the president is out of step. You know, I know that he feels very comfortable when he talks about cultural issues, but that when it comes to this particular cultural issue, it feels that he is out of step with where public opinion is. Obviously, you know, look, there's a couple of months still until the election, but at this point in time, his desire to return to what is comfortable, which are race, white politics of, you know, white grievance politics, that is not working for him at this moment.
Yeah. And if you have time for one more Michelle Obama clip, I'll get your reaction to that in the context of your last answer. But if you have to go, I'll just play it for the listeners and talk
about
yes, it.
Okay, yes. I got a couple of minutes. Yes, okay. That'll work.
So Michelle Obama, as she says out loud who she is demographically, to reach beyond the kinds of swing voters who both parties seem to be aiming at, or I should say, to reach to the kinds of swing voters who both parties seem to be aiming at, in addition to turning out the Democratic base. Listen.
Now, I understand that my message won't be heard by some people. We live in a nation that is deeply divided, and I am a Black woman speaking at the Democratic convention. But enough of you know me by now. You know that I tell you exactly what I'm feeling. You know I hate politics. But you also know that I care about this nation. You know how much I care about all of our children. So if you take one thing from my words tonight, it is this. If you think things cannot possibly get worse, trust me, they can and they will if we don't make a change in this election. If we have any hope of ending this chaos, we have got to vote for Joe Biden like our lives depend on it.
So that was very powerful, Asma, and much played this morning in sound bites on the networks, that one. But was that a turnout message for members of the base who didn't vote in 2016? Or was that a Trump is more threatening than I am and Joe Biden is message for largely white suburban women, or was she trying to make it both at once?
I think it was a turnout message. You know, she has focused quite a bit on the need to energize voters and get out and vote. And I don't know if people caught this, if they were not watching it on TV, but she was wearing a necklace with the words vote on it. She was clearly trying to emphasize to people that it's important to get out and vote. And she talked about, you know, what I thought, which was really interesting, Brian, you know, we've heard so much from Democrats about the need to register for vote by mail, make sure you get your vote by mail ballots in time. She said even, you know, if necessary, vote early, vote in person. We have to get our shoes, put on our masks, and wait in line. And to me, that was significant because what she seemed to be saying was, this election is so important, put on your masks and wait in person and wait in line to vote in person if needed.
And I'm going to let you go because I know you have other work to do. Just because you're, you know, an NPR political correspondent doesn't mean you have anything to do on convention week. You can just stay here and chat with me all day. So I'm going to let you go. And then I'm going to play that exact Michelle Obama clip that you just referred to in case people didn't hear it. So Asma Khalid, NPR political correspondent. She's also co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. I saw you drop one of those in the 11 o'clock hour last night, a half hour after they finished. Are you going to do another one tonight?
That's right. We'll be doing one after the convention wraps every single night this week.
Okay. There you go. More good listening. Asma, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And here's that Michelle Obama clip, definitely a turnout message for the base, framed as a line of defense against threats they face.
We have to vote for Joe Biden in numbers that cannot be ignored. Because right now, folks who know they cannot win fair and square at the ballot box are doing everything they can to stop us from voting. They're closing down polling places in minority neighborhoods. They're purging voter rolls. They're sending people out to intimidate voters, and they're lying about the security of our ballots. These tactics are not new. But this is not the time to withhold our votes in protest or play games with candidates who have no chance of winning. We have got to vote like we did in 2008 and 2012. We've got to show up with the same level of passion and hope for Joe Biden. We've got to vote early, in person if we can. We've got to request our mail-in ballots right now, tonight, and send them back immediately. And follow up to make sure they're received. And then make sure our friends and families do the same. We have got to grab our comfortable shoes, put on our masks, pack a brown bag, dinner, and maybe breakfast too, because we've got to be willing to stand in line all night if we have to.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.